Hello and welcome to 23, the podcast for young, sharp-tongued and fucking fabulous people who love to talk shit. Today we have a very special episode. Kelsey, care to elaborate?
So for the past, I don't know, if you've listened to this podcast, you probably would have heard me talk about this project that I'm working on. It's for my kind of last ever university journalism assignment. And it originally started as an investigation into gender disparity in the music industry, but the more that I looked into it, the more that I realized it went deeper than just gender. And it went deeper than just the music industry. It's about race and religion and who's invited to make music and who's not invited to make music. And I found out that social media is changing that game completely, which is great, but it also has ramifications as well. Social media is not the nicest place in the world, and it does create a lot of pressure for people. So I fortunately got to sit down with Serene. She actually made our podcast music,
and she is amazing.
Yeah, so incredibly talented. Just as a white person researching this, I kind of, not that I went into it naively, I feel like I'm a progressive person. I always try to educate myself on issues that don't affect me because I want to be a good citizen. I want to be somebody that understands these problems and can act on them and can make the world a better place. Even still, things like when I was writing this report up, were every single time I typed in Serene's name or I typed in a name that wasn't Western, it always came up as it didn't recognize it, or it would autocorrect it to screen or something like that because it just didn't recognize the name. And little things like that I have never had to worry about, ever.
It is so wild that something as simple as your name, which is such an integral part of your identity, is just being changed constantly. How horrible that would make you feel, how disconnected to your sense of self, how stressful that would be. I couldn't even imagine.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just things like that, which I guess as a white person, I never would have had to think of. And also there was lots of things in this that I really wanted to dive deep into, but I didn't have enough time. I had a time limit on this. I wasn't allowed to go over 20 minutes, which I really wish I could have because this topic goes so much deeper than social media and how we're using it now. I mean, Western music is so heavily influenced by Arabic music, and it always has been. Arabic music has kind of led the way in terms of chord progressions and the scales that we use and the rhythm and all of that stuff. And in a lot of cases, Western music has stolen that from Arabic music and just hasn't been credited. I mean, we wouldn't have the guitar today without Middle Eastern people migrating throughout the world. Like, the guitar is a direct descendant of the lute, which originated in Persia. It's kind of like a really old school, kind of just looks like a
string instrument.
Yeah, a string instrument. We wouldn't have a lot of instruments without Middle Eastern immigration. We wouldn't have that. And I think we don't ever talk about that. We don't know this stuff. We don't learn it in music theory because it's heavily westernized. And I think without doing that research, how would I ever know that? It was a really good learning experience for me. And I hope everybody that listens to this will kind of learn something from it too, and we can go forth and be better citizens for it and kind of question your own privilege and where you stand in this situation. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this little
extra
fun. Yeah. I spoke to a lot of scholars, spoke to a lot of researchers, and yeah, really interesting stuff. So I hope you enjoy it, and please let us know what you think about it.
Please do.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
You have to be so different in order for someone to listen to your music. So yeah, I just remember by the next day it had reached 1 million. I went to work, everyone was freaking out. And then the day after that, it was 2 million.
In the last couple of years, there's been a shift in the way we use social media. They're now political mobilizers, job hunting arenas, and for some people, a way to bypass the gatekeepers of a music industry lacking diversity. For minorities like Serene Omran, who you just heard, this power shift has been instrumental in creating opportunities. But is it enough? My name is Kelsey Menzies, and this is Mic Check.
Hi.
Hi, Serene. Can you
Serene is a music producer from Sydney. She's a Palestinian Muslim woman, and recently she's gained a following of nearly 120,000 people on TikTok.
Honestly, I would just do it for fun. Like, with my friends from work, we'd be like, oh, let's do this TikTok challenge. Like, it was nothing serious. I never expected to, like, do music on it.
So take me back to that day when everything changed for you.
It was like 12 a.m. This motivation just comes out of nowhere. I don't know if you guys like understand what that is, but literally 12 a.m. ready to go to bed. I'm in my PJs. I get up and I just sit on my desk and I was like, okay, what's the most popular song on TikTok right now? Say So. I've been hearing that shit everywhere. Like, it's crazy.
Say So by Doja Cat has been used over 18.8 million times on the app. A dance accompanying the song went viral, and even celebs like Laura Dern and Mackenzie Ziegler hopped on board. With stats like that, making a video with Say So is nearly impossible to get any type of recognition. But Serene remixed the song and she created this.
And I didn't even know where I was going. Like, I didn't even know that much about, like, mixing and stuff at this point. And I swear, I posted it that night around, like, 2 a.m., went to bed, woke up the next day, my phone is blowing up. And it was unreal.
Serene's video now has nearly 3 million views and 700,000 likes.
First up, I changed the BPM from 148 to 120.
When you go on Serene's TikTok page, you'll see a plethora of how-to-do-it-yourself type styles of TikToks, where Serene walks you through the steps of producing a song or remixing a hit.
Growing up as a Muslim Arab, you don't ever, like, for example, I know for a fact my parents didn't see that for me, because it was like, wait, so music doesn't really, like, make money, or, like, it's so hard for musicians to make it. Like, that's facts, you know? Like, in the past, a lot of times that I've been rejected is simply because I am, like, straight up front Muslim.
The way we consume, produce, and distribute music has changed drastically in the past 5 decades. Digital technologies have essentially been the meteorite of the music industry, pushing those who failed to adapt to extinction and those who have to evolution. Artists like Ava Max, Megan Thee Stallion, Lil Nas X, they all have their roots in social media. Stunnin' by Curtis Walters has over 35 million streams on Spotify and 19 million views on YouTube, a song which Walters purposely used TikTok for to generate hype.
In a word, the primary difference is gatekeepers. So if we're talking 1970s, 1980s, even 1990s, record production required expensive equipment and expertise and investment to produce the physical record. In a sense, there are still gatekeepers, but also a lot of those barriers have fallen away.
Dr. Sarah Keith is a senior lecturer in media and music at Macquarie University. Those gatekeepers she's referring to, they're the record labels, the accessibility of production and recording equipment, the PR and marketing teams. Digital technologies have essentially democratized those barriers, but it's also presented challenges. Not only do artists have to be musically talented, they also have to be social media gurus.
An artist really, to develop a sustainable career, needs to develop a brand over multiple channels. They need to know their audience, which might be different on every channel, and they need to figure out how to deliver their brand to the audience in a sustainable and profitable way.
The ability to download music has arguably rocked the industry more than the Beatles, giving rise to the superstar of consumption, streaming. Now, the music industry contributes between $4 to $6 billion every year to the Australian economy, which, yeah, seems lucrative, and yet only 16% of Australian musicians make more than just $50,000 a year. With some streaming platforms paying just 0.006 cents per stream, what can artists do in this environment? Build authentic relationships with their audiences.
An authentic relationship is one that lasts over time. With Spotify, sure, it's easy to get streams, but if everyone streams your song only once and never comes back to listen to your music again, that is not really doing you any favors in terms of getting a career. All these artists who might have been dismissed are now more able to be heard. But this isn't something that's completely new to social media. It has happened previously with things like TV talent shows, like Australian Idol. With that, we started to see more diverse artists coming up, like Guy Sebastian, Jessica Mauboy, Casey Donovan. So it's not really likely that labels would have signed or worked with these artists on their own But because of the TV talent show format, they kind of have this track record of being popular with the public. So social media, I think, works in the same way.
How did you feel when they said TikTok bans might be happening in Australia?
Obviously, I was scared and like, I was like, okay, that's it. Like, it's over. If TikTok is gone, because TikTok was a big platform to so many minorities. Like, it was like, it wasn't just, you saw everybody on TikTok, every color, every ethnicity, every religion. And that's what was so like refreshing about it.
In August, Donald Trump signed twin executive orders banning future downloads of TikTok and WeChat from September. In June, India banned the app along with 59 others with ties to China, both countries citing security concerns.
I don't know if people will still listen to me.
For a second, it looked like the app might be banned here too, but in August, the Australian federal government decided against banning the app. But it still remains in a delicate situation. Research released in September from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute solidified concerns echoed by the global community back in June. I spoke to Daria Impiombardo, who worked on the report, about the findings.
Censorship on TikTok takes a much more nuanced form than the censorship that takes place on WeChat. Their content moderation guidelines started with a blunt approach to censorship that very much resembled the content moderation guidelines that are very common within the PRC.
So concerns that a lot of the governments around the world are citing, data mining, privacy, censorship of key political issues, are they valid?
Well, I think the concerns are as valid as those surrounding censorship and foreign interference. The risks associated with data collection and privacy have been proven to be very high. All those concerns surrounding the Chinese ownership of ByteDance are legitimate and founded on the structure of the Chinese legal system. We have also found virtually no separation between TikTok and its Chinese operations. So all the data TikTok collects can be actually accessed by its Chinese operators. And that in itself should be a major concern.
My chat with Daria left me feeling like a TikTok ban in Australia might just be a matter of time. It also left me feeling conflicted, knowing how essential the app was becoming for minorities breaking into the creative industries. I thought back to Serene's profile. Nearly every third or fourth video is an Arabic Western remix. I remember thinking this was the only place I would be able to find content like this.
You come to a Western country and suddenly you have to alter a lot of the stuff that you believe in, and they have to like open your mind to the culture here, because it is very, very different than like the Arab culture, and that's like fine. That's when intersectionality comes in, because like you can't just be one or the other. You have to be both.
Hi Amanda, how are you?
I'm grand, Kelsey. How are you? It's so nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's nice.
Amanda Coles is a senior lecturer at Deakin University. 3 years ago, Dr. Coles helped write the Skipping a Beat report about gender diversity in the music industry.
Some of the things weren't surprising, right? It's like, guess what? Women are underrepresented. They get fewer opportunities to get into the industry. There's fewer women in lineups. They're less visible in the industry. All around, if we have an industrial landscape that is characterized by gender inequality at all levels, that business model gets disrupted, but the power relations remain fundamentally intact. Sometimes we tend to fall into a bit of like a technological utopian analysis. And you're right, technology does create opportunities. Of course it does, right? But those opportunities aren't evenly distributed and open to everyone in the same way.
Women only hold 28% of senior strategic roles in the Australian music industry. I couldn't find any numbers on how many of those were people of colour. Only 1 out of 12 board members at Sony is black, and the other major record labels have pretty similar numbers.
My name is Vicky Gordon, and I'm currently the founding executive director and producer for Australian Women in Music Awards. Look, I've worked in the music industry for most of my life, really. Ironically, the music industry appears more flexible and more sort of sexy than it really is. Once you start working on the industry on the inside, you actually understand and can see how conservative it really is. The industry, unfortunately, it's like the patriarchal system, has been very effective in the way that it actually has almost convinced some women not to empower other women, to be threatened by other women. And we really need to see that change as well, because until that changes, until women get on, all women get on board with empowering other women, we're really not going to see the change that we need to see either.
I want to know why you decided to make the Australian Women in Music Awards. Women make up just 21.7% of artists, 12.3% of songwriters, and 2.1% of producers worldwide. Is that why you made the awards?
I just couldn't sit back anymore and watch people forever promising that things were going to change and forever making no change whatsoever. I think the Australian Women in Music Awards was just a really positive way to continue to have conversations about the issues that matter to women and non-binary and gender diverse and, you know, all the minority groups. It was a really positive way to embrace those groups of people while still tackling the harder issues.
The fact that we're getting a sliver of our society's stories as part of our cultural landscape is so problematic, right? Look at the insane debate around, what was it, Old Town Road, about whether a black rapper could do country music. If that doesn't tell you everything you need to know.
Old Town Road by Lil Nas X went viral on, yep, you guessed it, TikTok. It started on the Billboard's country chart before it was controversially kicked off for not being country enough. It then spent 19 weeks at the top of the Billboard's Hottest 100, making it undeniably the biggest song of 2019. You would think with a success like that, he would have gone home with the Grammy. Well, he didn't.
Racialization is that those repetitive acts of prejudice, stereotyping, implicit and explicit forms of racism.
Dr. Shireen Idris is a postdoctoral research fellow at Deakin University. Her work examines the everyday life of migrant young people, vocation and aspirations.
But the most important component of understanding racialization is that it's a process and it's repetitive actions, words, symbols, gestures, media representations. The repetitive ways that those messages get transmitted into society is what then sort of shapes an ordinary citizen's perspective of what you are or who you are and where you sort of fit in the social hierarchy.
Me growing up, not once have I seen myself represented in any way. You know why? You know why there's no representation of Muslim people, or if there was, why it's so wrong? It's because they're not letting Muslim writers do it.
Yeah.
They're not letting Muslim people into the creative industry to just do their thing.
I'm here on the set of Serene's short film, Towelhead.
Okay, action!
Without giving too much away, can you tell me what Towelhead is about?
It's a short film about a Palestinian Muslim girl living in Western Sydney, Australia. It deals with a lot of like inner struggle and self-discovery, at the same time dealing with like discrimination in the Western world and how people view you. Like, you might have an idea of yourself that you're like so sure of, but someone might come along and just break it down for you.
How do you feel directing your first short film?
When you have that, I guess, weight on your shoulder, you just want to make sure that you don't mess it up, because it's no joke when you write about like a Muslim character or like a Muslim woman character, because there's not much of it, and people are sick of seeing the same stuff of like, you know, the only way that she feels liberated is by taking off the hijab.
Misrepresentation and stereotyping is one of the biggest barriers for creatives. Australia builds its reputation on the backbone of multiculturalism, and it should. Census data shows nearly 30% of our population being born overseas, and yet the literature paints a very different picture.
There are so many layers to it, right? So there's like the product that you see that uses those tired tropes. In this instance, we're talking about, you know, Arab and Muslim men as criminals, as drug dealers, as, you know, very working class.
Dr. Mahal Krayem wrote a book in 2017 titled Heroes, Villains and the Muslim Exception. In it, she wrote about the history of misrepresentation in Australia and the Orientalist or ambivalent lens through which Muslim or Arabic people are framed.
You have news media that is perpetuating these kinds of stereotypes. Then you have fiction that is playing into that. And so for people, it kind of just like, well, this must be real, right? Like, this must speak to some kind of truth. I guess people use stereotypes as like a shorthand, right? They're conveying a lot of information very quickly. But for communities who have been marginalized historically, it's not just detrimental, but I think in some ways it's almost violent as well, right? Like, it's an experience of some kind of violence, mm-hmm. where the oppression that they experience more broadly, especially if it's political or, you know, outside of the world of fiction, they are then re-traumatized by in these fictional worlds.
Western stereotypes of Muslim communities, those racializations Dr. Idris talked about, go unchallenged in our film, television and music every day. One study found that 91% of articles about Muslims were negative. Another study placed the figure at 70%.
Once a Muslim woman actually wants to like be successful, she's brought down, like all the way to the ground, man.
I think to kind of romanticize social media is dangerous. But I do think that it just gives people space to imagine for themselves something else, right? Something different. And this is the thing that is so powerful about popular culture or anything that is fictional, is the fact that the limit is your imagination. And what makes these things so disappointing sometimes is the fact that they're so limited, right? So it's like, well, whose imagination did you tap into? Because that's pretty sad if this is the best kind of world that you can imagine.
As a white person, I won't ever have to think about the correlation between what I'm wearing and getting a job. I probably won't ever have to make a movie about my experience because it's been done so many times before. I wouldn't have to rely on social media apps as much as you do if I was pursuing a job in the music industry. That in itself is a privilege and something I think I take for granted. What do you think needs to be done to bridge that gap?
Like, people just need to educate themselves. And I keep saying that because it's like, if you want the world to be a better place and just a peaceful place for everyone to live in harmony, you guys need to do the work, because we're doing the work. You know, we're trying to educate you, but it shouldn't be our jobs anymore.
When we're talking about gender, this is not a proxy for white women, right? This means that white women have to interrogate who sits on the board of women in music. What do our festivals look like? What do our, you know, how do our own decision-making structures produce and reproduce white supremacist relationships?
People in the arts industry are going to have to confront their white fragility, and they're going to have to confront their historical biases, and they're going to be called to account for that. And this is one of the great things about social media, right? That we do get to have some accountability. We're going to see a big change in who is running big arts organizations and who is responsible for where the funding goes. But I think more than that, I think we're about to enter a phase where we're playing by completely different rules. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what that looks like.
I got in contact with people from like Spotify, like people that were reaching out to me, which was crazy. Last time I checked, it was like around 100,000 streams. And I was like, okay, that's pretty crazy because it's just an instrumental. Like, you know what I mean?
That instrumental Serene's talking about, that's the one you're listening to now.
If I didn't do TikTok at all, I would be sitting at like less than 1,000. You know how like Spotify has this like less than 1,000 streams? Yeah, that would be me.
Social media has changed the relationship between consumer, artist, and organization. Record labels still hold huge power, and the industry has a long way to go with diversity. But that power is slowly dripping into the hands of artists like Serene and audiences like you. It may just be a matter of time before that drip turns into a tsunami.
There's just a bunch of stuff that I see for myself, and I truly believe that I can reach if I just go at the pace that I'm going at. But, you know, my motto is, like, just work hard no matter what. Because if something is worth it, if you really believe in something, it will happen for you.
I hope you have enjoyed this episode. The full interview with Serene will be released next week. It's about a 40-minute interview. Serene was so incredibly generous with her time and her story. And just tolerating me, really, with all my questions and my prodding and probing. And I couldn't thank her enough for being a part of this. She really was instrumental in this happening. So that interview will be released next week. It is so, so interesting. I really hope you guys tune into that.
And also follow Serene on Instagram. Give her some love, because this chick is so talented and we love supporting her, and we love that we've been able to share her story through our platform, and we're so lucky that she wanted to share her story through our platform. So everyone that follows us or listens to our podcast, definitely go give her some love, and hopefully she gets bigger and better than ever.
Yeah, so I'll put her handle in our show notes.
Whoop, whoop. We love a handle.
Okay, thanks, Belle.
Thanks, Kels. Love
you. Bye. Ya.
Bye. Bye.